Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. It is the early morning of Monday, April 29th, 2024. And today we continue our discussion of the Seat Working Paper series. Today we are on number 15. The title of that is Extraterritorial Taxation, number 15, Taxing in Respect of Rights. Taxing in Respect of Rights, an ambiguous title, which we will explore today. And of course, I am joined by Karen Alpert in Australia and Laura Snyder of Paris. And I'd like to invite Karen to lead our discussion today. Karen?
Well, thanks, John. This is actually somewhat of an interesting paper because it's talking about some of the, well, it's a critique of one of the proposals that has been made in the past to replace citizenship taxation with something that's being called residence-based taxation. You can see the air quotes, right? And you know, one of the constant complaints that people have about the U.S. moving to residence-based taxation is that, oh, any change has to be tight against abuse. Well, what kind of abuse are they worried about? What do you think, Laura? Do you think, what kind of abuse do you think these people are worried about?
Well, you can only guess because, and whatever it is they're worried about, it's invented. Because when you look at actual examples of abuse, almost every single one of them, if not all of them, come from people who have lived in the United States, made their fortune in the United States, and have recently left the United States and, you know, are perceived to be leaving in order to escape U.S. income tax obligations. And that's not what's happening with overseas Americans. They, you know, they've lived overseas for a long time and, you know, they're struggling with a tax system in which 60% of the returns that are filed show no tax was owed in the first place. So, you know, when there are groups purporting to propose solutions, say that it needs to be tied against abuse, it's really hard to know what they're talking about because they can't really point to examples of people living overseas who are abusing the tax system. Where we, it is actually, we've talked in the past about how the current system was created and is maintained on the basis of animus, which, and that animus is the assumption that, you know, we are all unpatriotic people who live overseas for the purpose of avoiding taxes. And you see that animus carried through into this proposal. There it is, that assumption again, that we're all, you know, we live overseas to avoid taxes. And so whatever changes are put in place, well, we got to make sure we're not abusing. Got to make sure there's no abuse, even though no one can show we've been abusing.
What do you think, John? What kind of abuse do you think they're trying to stop?
Well, you know, that's a very difficult question. I mean, could the abuse be that Americans overseas are paying taxes to other countries at all? Maybe the idea is that they should pay taxes only to America. Do you think it could be that?
You know, I wonder how much of this, of the animus that Laura mentions and the rhetoric in some of these proposals actually boils down to a simple confusion where people think that citizenship means residence. Because you hear that all the time. People talk about citizens as if they were residents when they're talking about tax in the U.S.
I think if you're talking about an ordinary person who's never really thought about these issues, yeah, like that could be what's going on. Yeah, that could be what's going on. But, well, yeah, I guess. But at a certain point, though, when you talk to the congressman and you explain that's not what's going on, and certainly these organizations that purport to know overseas Americans and purport to represent them, well, they're that mistake true. Is not
you true. Know, you, but I have heard several people in Congress who make that mistake. They don't, some of them just, until they really are confronted with it, some of them just don't understand the distinction.
Well, you know, Karen, on that point, in 2017, there was that FATCA hearing. And one of the congressmen who was the representative of the Democrats at the hearing actually said, all countries tax their citizens. Okay. Yeah, clearly that wasn't. I mean, it was just flat out.
Exactly. This is exactly what I mean.
Hard to have a discussion. I think that's right. Maybe all these discussions should start off with, we have citizens, we have residents, and there may or may not be overlap between the two.
Well, you see that in other areas too. Do you remember when, you know, they were rolling out the COVID vaccines and the federal government, they were saying, you know, we're going to make sure every American has access to a vaccine. Well, that's not really what they meant. What they meant was American people living in the United States. They sure as heck didn't mean U.S. citizens living outside the country, because when they asked for access to the vaccine, they were told point blank, no.
Well, you know, a very recent example of that was, I believe it was April 11th, was the Ways and Means Committee that had a hearing on how the TCJA benefited Americans. Okay. And interestingly, well, and unsurprisingly, the whole thing, a focus on, in the context of benefiting Americans, provisions of the tax code that benefited resident Americans. And I think one could reasonably conclude that overseas Americans are not Americans, right? So in other words, that's a way of equating Americans, citizenship and residence, you know, the same sort of thing. So I think that this is a problem in many ways, some of which are clearly obvious. But the larger problem is the inability of people in the United States to imagine a situation where it's normal for Americans to live outside the United States.
Yeah.
All right. Definitely. Okay. So we've got these proposals that want to be tight against abuse. So what are they going to do to be tight against abuse? Well, the one proposal was, well, so what, first of all, what the current system does to kind of be tight against abuse for people who are renouncing U.S. citizenship is to charge an exit tax. So, and with the idea being that all of the income that we wouldn't have been able to, we won't be able to tax now that you're no longer a U.S. citizen, we're going to tax it before you give up your citizenship. But they set a threshold that may have sounded high when they set it at assets of, or net worth of $2 million. And they did not index that for inflation, which means that more and more middle-class people are being caught up in what was supposed to be aimed at the very wealthy. So that's what they're doing now. The proposal, what was the proposal that were the papers critiquing? Laura, can you give us a rough outline?
Well, I'll mention a couple of things, and then you guys might realize that I've left some things out. The proposal included the need to apply for a departure certificate. And so in order to leave the tax system, they'd have to apply to the IRS for a departure certificate. In order to get that, they'd have to be up to date on their tax filing. And they would be... They, in order also to ask for the departure certificate, they'd have to pay a fee, which, funnily enough, would be exactly the same amount that you have to pay to get a certificate of loss of nationality today, $2,350. And then when you apply for this departure certificate, if you meet the asset or income thresholds that would apply today to qualify for the exit tax, then you'd be subject to a tax also at that time. And what else am I leaving? Oh, and also, once you are successfully out, which, by the way, you apply for it, so the IRS has to grant you this. I didn't see any discussion of the criteria that the IRS has to apply or how much time they have to respond. I didn't see that type of detail. So there's a lot of room for IRS abuse on that. And then each year, you'd have to make an annual filing with the IRS each year anyway. and stating under oath. So there you go. Lots of opportunities for, you know, just being penalized for doing something even inadvertently wrong. So under oath that you are a U.S. citizen and resident alien, that you fulfill the applicable requirements, that you continue to reside outside the country, that you're not in a tax haven country, you don't have income related to a restricted country. And if you don't file this annual certificate, then, you know, your status as a non-resident would be terminated. So again, you'd be right back into the full U.S. tax system. So, you know, again, what you see there is we've talked in the past about how the current system singles out people based on nationality, Americans living outside the United States, singles them out for treatment that no one else is subject to. Not Americans who, or anyone of any nationality living in the United States, and not people who aren't Americans living outside the United States. So here you are with all of these additional requirements targeted towards people of a particular nationality. You're just repeating the abuses of the current system. So it all because you have this animus towards them that you think that, you know, their purpose is to avoid U.S. tax.
Right. Yeah. And I take your point about the IRS having some scope there to abuse for abuse, because under the current system, you decide the date at which your assets are going to be measured for the exit tax once you get an appointment to renounce your citizenship, you can show up or you cannot show up if you decide that your assets values have changed. Or exchange rates, because exchange rates, if you've got foreign assets, play a big part in how much U.S. dollars your assets are worth. Whereas if you're under the proposed system, with the IRS would set the date. They would get to choose which date that your assets are being measured on, because they would be measured on the date that the departure certificate was issued.
And under the way that this particular proposal is written, there's no way to know if the IRS would ever have any obligation to issue a departure certificate. You know, we know that the IRS drags its feet on a lot of things.
It'd be 2 years in limbo, of course.
Or more.
It could be 6 months probably. In limbo now, waiting for an appointment. But, John, what do you think?
I think that it's not a question of individual Americans abusing the tax system. I think it's a question of the tax system clearly abusing Americans. And, you know, one of a great example of this is that I woke up today reading the government's brief and the appeal of the Christensen case, which was this case where it was held that U.S. citizens living in France who were subject to the net investment income tax on French source investment income should be allowed to use tax paid to France as a tax credit under the U.S.-France tax treaty. And, you know, I was, without getting into the details, I was shocked and appalled by the assumptions in the, you know, in the government's brief appealing this thing, you know, including, get this, okay, that Americans abroad in France should not get this tax credit because they already got a benefit under the foreign earned income exclusion. They were somehow double dipping. And this is unbelievable stuff. I mean, they have no relationship.
Not earned income.
I know. I mean, they're completely out of their mind. Another gem was that somehow the U.S. Treasury technical interpretation of the tax treaty should be used to interpret the tax treaty. I mean, you know, in my opinion, the government's brief should be understood publicly what it really is, which is a U.S. declaration of war on all countries that it has a tax treaty with, because it's perfectly clear that their understanding of the treaty and citizenship taxation is that it's a way for the U.S. to plant flags in other countries and essentially claim a portion of tax base of that other country as part of the U.S. tax base. I mean, this stuff is unbelievable.
Yeah. Getting back to this proposal we were critiquing, I think we need to to recognize that this is not residence-based taxation because citizenship still matters to what your ongoing requirements are. You may no longer have to pay after you get the departure certificate, which, as we've said, is a problem. You may no longer have to pay U.S. tax, but you still have to file FBARs and file an annual recertification. So like Laura said, just perpetuating the same human rights violations that the current system has.
Absolutely. It's a continuation of citizenship taxation. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. I mean, the kind of thing you can say about this is that we retain citizenship taxation, but we just simply improve it a little bit so that it's not quite as abusive as it was. The only solution to this is to completely and absolutely sever citizenship from tax residency, meaning that citizenship is not relevant to the payment of income tax. That's the only thing that will solve this problem for all people, all the time, under all circumstances. And interestingly, only SEAT and Republicans overseas are willing to take that position.
Right. Okay, so what SEAT would like to see happen is to see the U.S. move from a citizenship-based system to a residence-based system. And all these proposals say, oh, no, you got to watch out about the, you know, that's going to be abused. But we've got another 180, 190 countries that have a residence-based tax system. Aren't they worried about abuse?
Certainly they are. Some of them are quite worried about abuse, but they address it in a very different way. And I should say they're not worried about abuse by their citizens. They're worried about potential abuse by their residents, not their citizens.
Exactly. So they're not looking at trying to collect tax on income that's generated outside of their country by at all. They're not, I mean, that by people who don't live inside the country. So, you know, if you're a Canadian living in Australia with virtually no financial, no income coming from Canada, you're working in Australia, Canada doesn't tax you, right? Right, John?
Canada does not have citizenship taxation.
That's right. So Australia would tax it.
Yeah, but what about that is relatively sticky residence rules. In other words, it's not that easy to sever tax residency with Canada. I mean, you really have to kind of clear out of the country to do that. Okay.
But if you did clear out of the country, you would be able to do it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you can also do it effectively through a tax treaty, right?
Right.
Which U.S. citizens cannot do because of the saving clause. I mean, the best thing for a Canadian probably would be to move to a country with sort of an OECD type tax treaty with a standard treaty tax breaker provision that just says, you know, that your tax, your country of residence is where you have your permanent home, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So this is one way a lot of countries do try and protect against the abuse of people moving away from their country to avoid tax. And that's by making by playing with the residence rules. So I know Australia's had a recent review of the residence rules. I don't believe any actual change has happened yet, but a lot of countries have some pretty tight and sticky residence rules where it's difficult to break residence. So that's one thing they do. Another thing a lot of countries do, and more over time, is they impose some sort of departure tax. So if someone were to leave Canada, John, what kind of tax would they be up to from Canada?
Well, the general principle is that when they leave Canada, there would be a deemed sale of assets that the Canada Revenue Agency loses the ability to tax easily. In other words, Canadian situs assets. So It would go after the increase in, you know, capital gains for shares, et cetera. But what it does exclude, importantly, are pensions, pension-based things, right?
Right. And it would also exclude, I would expect, real property in Canada?
Yes. Yes. Because
other than the primary residence, which is tax-free anyways.
Yeah, the primary residence is tax-free anyway. But yeah, it excludes Canadian real estate. I mean, it excludes everything that Canada can easily tax down the road.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, it goes after stuff that, you know, it's hard for them to tax. But I think most and very importantly, it does go after pension plans.
Right.
You know, which the U.S. thing does. And I really think the most egregious thing in the whole U.S. exit tax system is the taxation of non-U.S. pensions that were accumulated during years when the citizen didn't live in the United States, right? So, you know, we have an American citizen who moves to, anywhere, Canada, for example.
Australia.
They have their whole career in that country. They have a pension in that country. They want to renounce U.S. citizenship. And the U.S. says, well, you know, I think the reasoning is because U.S. citizenship is a property interest the government has in the person because the U.S. owns the person. Therefore, the U.S. owns what the person owns. Therefore, the U.S. owns the non-U.S. pension and should be able to confiscate a good part of it if the person renounces U.S. citizenship. You know, that would be the chain of reasoning. And this is amazing stuff because, you know, over a lifetime, you can have a pension with a present value of, you know, $1.5 million easily. And this is treated as a deemed distribution, right? So in other words, they say, well, you know, it's worth $1.5 million. So you're going to have to include that in your income and, you know, pay tax on $1.5 million, even though you've never received it.
And even though you don't have the cash to pay the tax.
Absolutely. Because if but this is, you know, interestingly, this is not the U.S. citizen abusing the U.S. tax system. I mean, do you think I'm accurate in saying this is clearly the U.S. tax system abusing the citizen?
True.
I mean, I don't think there's any question about it.
I think you also have to point out that the Canadian departure tax, just like the Australians and the French, apply to people who leave the country regardless of their citizenship.
Right. If you've been a tax resident and you cease tax residency, then it applies.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, only the United States defines tax residency in terms of citizenship, right? You know, understand, this is a status-based thing. So in other words, in the U.S., you're taxable because of the circumstances of your birth. Mostly citizenship is a circumstance from birth, agreed? Not based on the circumstances of life, the way the rest of the world does. So the U.S. is really, you know, I think culturally, and of course, the tax system is nothing more than a reflection of the culture, really medieval kind of system, right? Where it's based on status, who you are. But I mean, we see this consistently. You know, U.S. nationals are somehow exempt from this, you know, because of their status as a national, notwithstanding the fact that nationals travel on a U.S. passport, have the right to move to the United States, in the same way the green card holders and U.S. citizens do. We see the status in terms of just the fact that the green card gives them status subject to worldwide taxation, irrespective of, you know, their actual connection to the United States, etc. I mean, you know, this is amazing stuff. I mean, I remember with amusement years ago, you know, in the sort of Obama fantasy land presidency, when the president said, the circumstances of your birth should never determine the outcome of your life. What kind of nonsense is this? I mean, the point is that U.S. citizenship is a huge determinant in the outcome of your life.
So basically what other countries are doing is, number one, they're making their residence requirements a bit sticky so that you have to really sever your economic ties to the country to get rid of tax residents. And they're applying a departure tax. That strikes me as being a lot better targeted towards the abuse that people seem to be worried about than the U.S. exit tax or these other proposals. Would you agree with that, Laura?
Absolutely. I don't think, you know, any of us would say that these other systems are perfect. I'm sure that they've all got their flaws. But, you know, on the scale of things, they're much closer to what should be happening in order to allow people to live their lives, to have individual self-determination. What you have with these U.S. laws is people, because of their citizenship, they're not really free to live their lives the way they want to live them, either because they don't leave the United States, because they actually learn about these laws, and so they don't go. Or when they live outside the United States, they have all sorts of constraints on their lives that other people don't have. And you don't see people who aren't Americans having any of these issues.
Well, you know, though it's a privilege to be an American citizen, so maybe these are just, maybe it's just the price you pay for the privilege of being American. What do you think?
John, we've talked about this. Citizenship is a constitutional and a human right. Human rights are something that you have by virtue of being you are a human being. Constitutional rights you have by virtue of being connected to that particular state. These are not rights that you need to earn or that you even need to deserve. They exist as they are, and if you need to earn or deserve or pay for them, they are not rights.
Well, you know, you make a very good point, Laura, but I mean, you know, what I'm suggesting is that they're not rights in the United States. I mean, this is part of the problem here, that from a U.S. perspective, there are constitutional rights. There are not human rights. I mean, that's the real nub of the problem, I think, right?
But even constitutional rights do not need to be earned or deserved. And citizenship is a constitutional right. You see that in, well, the Equal Protection Clause that says if you are born in the United States, you are a citizen. They are right there. You've established citizenship as a constitutional right. You see it in a series of Supreme Court cases out of the 50s and 60s. So, you know, you don't even need to enter into the realm of human rights for this one.
Well, their answer to that would be, yeah, you have a constitutional right to be a citizen, but, you know, what it means to be a citizen is a different issue. That's how I think they would. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just exploring.
Well, I know that that's how they would look at it because, you know, they say, oh, it's a privilege of, you know, you have rights and privileges of your citizenship. Well, if you want to talk about citizenship has different meanings. There is the, you know, the legal term of, you know, do you have the right to a passport of that country and the voting and, you know, what you're granted under the 14th Amendment. There's that citizenship. And then there's the larger, I can't think of the right way to describe it, but the idea that you are part of a community. And when you're part of a community, you have certain rights and obligations. That's where they talk about, well, okay, as part of this community, you have an obligation to pay taxes. That's a separate definition of the word citizenship and a separate issue. We're talking about the type of citizenship that everybody needs, because everybody in the world needs a citizenship, because if you don't have at least one, you have no rights at all. You're stateless. That's the type of citizenship we're talking about. That's the type of citizenship that is not a privilege. It is a human right. And again, if you don't have at least one, you are considered to suffer deplorable human rights violations because you have no rights. And so no, U.S. taxation is not the privilege of U.S. citizenship. There are no privileges, or it's not the price of U.S. citizenship. There is no and should be no price to that type of citizenship.
Well, the way you're talking, you know, the idea is that nobody should be without a citizenship, et cetera. I mean, under that kind of reasoning, would that apply to people who are already dual citizens? What about that? Can you make a distinction between dual citizens and people with only U.S. citizenship?
Well, so first of all, you're saying, okay, then we should be able to abusively tax dual citizens and not people who are only U.S.
I'm wondering if that isn't a reasonable inference from the way you're describing this. And then I would add that actually dual citizens from birth are privileged.
The 14th Amendment gives U.S. citizenship to people born in the United States. It doesn't say except if they're dual citizens.
Well, that is true. But so you have a citizenship, but that's a different issue from what it means. I mean, I think we agree on that, right? But the question is whether that citizenship means different things, you know, if you're born a dual citizen as opposed to not. And I think we see very, very clearly that assuming for a minute that tax policy is a reflection of society, I mean, I find it fascinating that dual citizenship from birth in the United States actually creates a very special and privileged kind of citizenship, right? I mean, what's happened in the tax code is that it's through the tax code, the United States has created essentially a caste system of citizenship, right? Where regardless of the theory, the reality is that those who are dual citizens from birth are privileged citizens.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's just, you know, one more indication of how Americans who leave the United States are perceived. Because I guess these, you know, the dual citizens, you could think about accidentals or people were Americans who were born outside the United States and born with another nationality. But these Americans who were born in the U.S., at the time they were born, they were only U.S. citizens. Well, if they leave the country and get another citizenship, well, that's a special kind of treachery.
Yeah, exactly. It warrants a very, very special kind of abuse.
Even if it's done when they're toddlers or, you know, in grade school, you know, kids.
I would argue, especially if it's done, you know, especially if it's done, because then it's not done out of necessity. It's just done. I mean, look, let's not kid ourselves here. For the history of U.S. citizenship is by and large a history of the United States weaponizing citizenship against its people, essentially, right? And it's really only been, and do you think for a minute that if the Afforian case hadn't been decided that it was, you think the U.S. citizenship would operate the way it does today? Not a chance. You know, they would continue their
strategy. I think if you hadn't had those series of decisions from the Warren Court, of course it would continue. Of course it would continue because you see it continuing in an indirect way. The Warren Court decisions basically said you cannot deprive people of their citizenship in this direct way. So now what you have are all these indirect ways to deprive people of their citizenship.
The Warren Court?
Yeah, those decisions were under Earl Warren, Afram and Schneider.
Okay. Well, the Supreme Court at the time, whatever it was, 67, was that still the Warren Court? Anyway, that's not material. But, you know, so we've got a series of cases leading up to Afforian. And that was a 5-4 decision, right? I mean, that was not exactly a resounding victory, was it? 4 of the 9 judges in this 1967 case of Afforian would have been perfectly happy to rule that the U.S. could continue its weaponization of citizenship by stripping people of citizenship for any reason prescribed by Congress. Agreed?
Mm-hmm. Right. But if that had happened, we might not be in quite the problem we're in now, because you wouldn't have so many dual citizens floating around.
Well, there's no question about it that the decision of Afforian really planted the seeds of the tax problems of today.
I don't think that you can take what the Warren Court did out of context. Those protections of citizenship came right after after World War II, when you had all sorts of abuses of citizenship going on. I don't think you can and what the Warren Court did was a reaction to that, just like what, you know, the UN did with the Human Rights Declarations did. That was all a reaction to the abuses of World War II.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, going back to the present, how are we going to fix everything?
There's only one fix.
And what's that, John?
Well, citizenship has to be severed from tax residency. That's the legislative fix. We have a regulatory fix that we've talked about. And yeah. The issue of the tax treaty fix, you know, which is essentially getting rid of the saving clause.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the three ways of doing it, right? Obviously, the preferred way would be to completely sever citizenship from tax residency. But that is precisely what very few people are willing to advocate. And I think it's important, you know, to be clear here that, you know, even things like the holding bill from 2018 was not residency-based taxation. It continued citizenship taxation and simply expanded the foreign earned income exclusion, right? And basically, you have to be able to cut this off at the head, where there's no way under U.S. law that citizenship can be relevant for income taxation. And until these organizations commit to that, we know they're not serious about getting rid of citizenship taxation. Or do you think that's too strong?
I think that's right. I think, you know, like what they should be playing with is the definition of residence rather than, you know, trying to make it easier for non-resident citizens to live their lives under the current system.
Right. So in other words, we say, you know, so you're sitting around a table and you say, all right, so we agree that citizenship is no longer the criterion for tax residency. We agree that circumstances of birth are no longer the criterion for tax residency. What should matter are circumstances of life. And what we mean by circumstances of life are actual economic, physical connection to the country, which probably means something like living there, residence, etc.
Residence, domicile, possibly, if you want to be really sticky.
Maybe. Okay. But it has to have some kind of, you know, some kind of, I would not use domicile because of the technical meaning that the word has.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's very, very dangerous. As much as, you know, I mean, Canada.
Usual abode is.
Well, or, you know, Canada uses this phrase ordinary residence, you know.
Yeah, ordinary residence.
But I mean, something that captures that idea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, believe me, all you have to do is look around the world, look at Canada, look at Australia. They have residency based taxation. I can attest absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt that Canada has one of the most abusive tax systems ever known to man. In fact, it is part, I would say, that Canada, the United States, and France, for different reasons, constitute the tax axis of evil in the 21st century. Yeah, Canada and France have residence-based taxation.
Yeah. Okay. And what do you think about exit taxes? Should they be allowed?
You know, Canada had the original exit tax in 1996. You know, there's a certain history to it. I don't know. You're asking me personally. No, I mean, I'm opposed to all exit taxes. But if you ask me contextually, realistically, in the 21st century, are you going to be able to get rid of them? I don't think that you're going to be able to get rid of exit taxes. It's, in other words, some kind of a balloon tax payment due when people sever tax residency.
But that should be due when they sever tax residency, not sometime later.
That's exactly right. Now, you know, so one of the problems with the U.S. exit tax is that because it's based on renouncing citizenship or relinquishing citizenship, that it occurs after somebody, you know, has been a tax resident of another country, you know, for many, many years, right? You know, and has acquired pensions and things like that. The difference in exit tax rules, interestingly, between the United States and, say, Canada or another country, is largely the result, the implications of a citizenship tax-based system versus a residence-based tax system.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and this is another reason why, right? In other words, why don't we look at it this way? For the United States to move to residency-based taxation would provide a more rational and principled basis for imposing a departure tax.
Absolutely.
You know, like right now, it's just such indescribable bullshit. You know, it applies retroactively. You know, you've got people who lived out of the United States for 50 years, and all of a sudden since 2008. Oh, by the way, if you want to renounce citizenship, we're going to confiscate all the non-U.S. assets that you've acquired in the 50 years you haven't lived in the United States. Only a representative of U.S. Treasury could think that was reasonable. But the bottom line here is that...
Or a member of Congress.
Yeah, well, they would think it's reasonable without thinking about it. Okay. I mean, Congress people are just stupid. All right. You know, the problem with the people in Treasury is they're not stupid. They're unprincipled. You know, in other words, I mean, these are the people who actually think about these issues, right? I mean, let's be clear. You know, the people who do these treasury regs and tax treaties and stuff are not at all stupid, but they're highly committed to the principle that the United States should be able to tax people based on status, the status of being citizen, regardless of where they are in the world. And that's what makes them more dangerous, I think.
I think you're by and large right. Certainly most members of Congress don't think about this. Some definitely do. And
who are we talking about? Let's be clear. Who are we talking about?
Warren, White House.
Those are the two Democrats. Of course. Warren, White House, Wyden. Okay. They're identifiable because their surnames start with W. Right?
I think I could be wrong. I think Jason Smith, the head of the Ways and Means now, I think he thinks about these issues too, based on the conversations that we've had with members of his staff. I could be wrong. It's not as if Jason Smith has made any public pronouncements on these issues, you know, to really know what's in his head. But the other thing I was going to say is even if most members of Congress aren't really thinking about this, they have staff members who definitely are, not all of them, but a lot of them definitely are. And they do understand what's happening and they think it's fine. Their response is just renounce.
Yes, that is exactly right. So the question is, why do they think it's fine? And I think that to some extent, you know, we go back to a point that Karen made earlier today, is that there's a confusion between citizenship and residency. You know, I think that probably to the extent that there's an understanding of citizenship, maybe this is how people inside the United States see non, you know, I think they see them as escaped residents or something. You know, if you're a citizen, you're always a resident, just maybe you escaped or something like that. But look, you know, you're asking them to experience this. To experience something that can only be experienced by people who have not lived in the United States and been subject to this kind of abuse. And if you haven't, it's all purely theoretical. I mean, look at the tax fraud community, Treasury's warriors, right? You know, I mean, they're extremely dangerous because people think they understand this, right? And they don't. I mean, you know, we've written, you know, odds and ends recently exposing, you know, the depravity of their thinking. So, you know, there's this whole critical mass of people in varying capacities who really, really don't have the capacity to understand this all that well. And the difficulty in understanding is compounded by a tax system that is so complex that, I don't know, Karen, how many years do you think it would take some so-called tax professional figure this stuff out?
Look, I think anyone with less than maybe 10 years of experience trying to work through this really hasn't figured out any of the nuance yet.
I think that's right. I mean, I think 10 years is probably the minimum. But what happens is that they absorb these stupid sound bites like, well, it's just a filing issue. You know,
or you got to pay so that the Marines can come save you.
Yeah, or my favorite, the tax treaty prevents double taxation. Oh my God. The tax treaty facilitates double taxation because of the saving clause. I mean, where do they get these people from?
Yeah. So to sum up what we've talked about today, it's time to end the American system of extraterritorial taxation, right?
It would be a good idea, I think, to stop extraterritorial American taxation. Now, would you agree with that, Laura?
Absolutely. And that's what we named our organization, John.
No kidding. So where, Karen, would people find out more then?
They'd find out more at seatnow.org. And if you go to the working paper page, you'll find a link to download the original paper.
The entire
working paper series. And this is number 15 out of 16, as I recall, Laura. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
One more podcast to go.
Oh, not true at all. Laura's been busy since the 16 paper series. She's written even more, hasn't she?
I've written some more. There's one that I think I'd like to add to the working paper series, but I have not done it yet. The other things I've been writing have been published in different journals.
Do you think that when the history of the 21st century and taxation is written, it will be referred to as the Laura Snyder era?
I don't know about that. Your names might be there too.
Yeah, but Laura's the most prolific of us.
The most prolific, that's right. Now, I mean, regardless of whose other names are there, I think that we should simply rename the 21st century the Laura Snyder era in history.
Yeah. Anyways, I think that's a good note to stop on tonight. But thank you, John. And thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks, John.
All right. Thanks for all the papers, Laura.
Yeah,
sure.